Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Born in Quetta, raised in Lahore, Pakistan, computer scientist turned independent filmmaker Afia Nathaniel has lived in New York since 2001, arriving just weeks before 9/11. She came because Columbia University offered her a two-year Dean's Fellowship at its MFA film program. Afia currently teaches screenwriting there, as well as at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, and has mentored several student filmmakers here and in Pakistan. She's directed several short films, but her debut feature film, Dukhtar, which means daughter, was 10 years in the making. Afia wrote, co-produced, and co-edited the story about a mother and her young daughter who managed to escape from their home in the Pakistani mountains in an effort to save the child from an arranged marriage to a tribal leader. Afia was the only female in the 40-person film crew. Dukhtar premiered at the 2014 Toronto International Film Festival and was Pakistan's official submission in the foreign language category at the 87th Academy Awards. Afia is the recipient of the Adrian Shelley Award for Directors and was nominated for a 2013 Gotham Award. She's a New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow, a World Student Foundation Fellow, and in 2005 received a Hollywood Foreign Press Association grant. There's a lot of ground to cover in a conversation with someone like Afia, so let's end this intro and meet my guest today. Afia Nathaniel, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So tell me, how does one go from computer science to filmmaking, especially in Pakistan?
You make that leap because you love Star Trek. Well, you know, in growing up in Pakistan, I was educated there, obviously, and the way we are taught in schools, we really don't have the liberty to choose to do what we want to do. So if you do well in sciences, you end up in the science track. So I automatically ended up in the computer science, physics, math track.
You and I have the same.
So my bachelor's, I mean, I'm a trained computer scientist and a mathematician.
But let me go back to something that you said. We're not encouraged to do what it is we want to do.
Yes.
How did you know what it was you wanted to do?
I was always a storyteller, and I loved writing. My inroads into storytelling was always through my writing. And English we spoke really well, very fluently. So I wrote, you know, in English, short stories, novellas, poems. But that was considered a hobby. It was not ever considered something one should pursue, especially as a woman. Especially as a woman from a middle-class family, you know, who has to earn money. But, you know, I come from a very strong matriarchal family where education is encouraged, you know, very, very much. And so after finishing my computer science degree, I decided to switch gears and go into advertising. That was the closest thing one could get to in terms of
creativity.
You know, the media, creativity. There's no film schools. There's no film industry. So the only way to train yourself as a storyteller was through advertising, you know, make those cheesy 30-second commercials. And I always loved science fiction and, you know, thrillers, fantasy. So making that leap from paper into, storytelling on radio, television, newspapers.
So you wrote commercials. Is that
so,
what you're telling me?
Absolutely. I was a copywriter, and mm-hmm. I really loved that part. But then, you know, beyond a certain point, commercial storytelling is not that much of a
satisfying.
You know, it's not that satisfying. So that's when I started looking for schools. In between, I worked briefly in Europe.
So you left home?
I left home for good.
Was that common?
No, it was very uncommon. I thought I was going on a one-year internship to Switzerland. I worked with a women's nonprofit there in Geneva, the World YWCA. Mm-hmm. And that really gave me a flavor and love for hearing women's stories, you know, how they affect change in communities and the power within those stories that are often buried, you know, in our cultures, not in just one culture, but in many cultures.
Yes.
And that really gave me the impetus or the courage to go forward and then train myself formally. So I started applying to film schools.
It was as if you couldn't tamp it down.
Forgive
exactly.
the analogy. It's like yeah. acid reflux,
it
right?
Is. You can't stop it.
You can't. Yeah, it just keeps rising.
And that was a great experience in Europe. You know, I took on photography as a hobby. My eye was getting trained. I was writing screenplays. I was training myself in other ways. And then I got into film school at Columbia University in 2001. So I literally packed my bags, bought a one-way ticket, flew into New York in August.
Of 2001, like I said.
And a few weeks later, the Twin Towers fell. And, you know, it became a different world suddenly, you know, in some ways. But New York is the place I love, and it's my home, and this is where I want to be.
So here you are. You leave home, you leave Pakistan, what you know, for Switzerland, what you don't know. And then you come to New York, what clearly is so out of your purview.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you, A, and B, how did your family feel about this?
At first, it was pretty intimidating to be an international student in a foreign country. But then I think the Columbia University community really helped us.
Embraced you?
Reached out. They embraced us. We were not alone, you know, and that was a great feeling. You know, the students came together. We supported one another. And from it grew a way to tell stories that are not really heard, you know, from our parts of the world in ways. And that, you know, in a way that encouraged us even more to embrace that diversity, that kind of viewpoint that may be missing in mainstream cinema and storytelling. So mm-hmm. I think for us, especially for me, it was a way to embrace the change, to move forward. New York was going to be home. I fell in love in New York. You know, my husband's from India. We met in New York. This is our home. You embrace the change and go with it. And it's the best place, I believe, to be an independent filmmaker right now.
And the family support?
And the family. I mean, my parents supported me unconditionally.
Wonderful.
Which is why it all happened the way it happened.
And if they hadn't, you still would have come anyway?
I would have come anyway.
So now you're nurtured, mm-hmm. and not only are you nurtured, you're being taught mm-hmm. how to put this passion to paper, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You were part of the 5-year director's program. Is that the same for everybody?
As a screenwriter, you can graduate in 3 years and be done, but directing is far more intense and more work is required. And that's a great training, I think, as an artist, as a storyteller living in New York. I found myself writing the script for Dukhtar, which you've just mentioned, the feature film. And, you know, writing is very cathartic. It was a way to connect back with Pakistan and to write this story, especially that dealt with some very, you know, very touchy topics because of the film and the story. It deals with the story of a mother on the run in a very patriarchal society. And so the question becomes, what is at stake for her? What kind of a future does a woman like this have? And embedded within all of this is the idea of, you know, what are the forces of tradition, of fundamentalism and of modernity that are colliding together in a country that is not really seen in cinema. So all these things were coming together in the writing, in the expression, and ultimately became part of the fabric of what I did.
It was something that had been brewing in your brain, or did it just hit you like a Mack truck that you had to tell this story?
First, it hit me like a truck, and then it just grew and grew and grew, and it was very organic in that sense, the right, you know, the whole.
So we're talking 2001 you came, and if mm-hmm. you add 5 years to that, that's 2006, mm-hmm. and it was during the course of those 5 years, this movie had begun.
Yes, yes.
And so you graduate, mm-hmm. and then you say, I have to make this film.
Absolutely. And in another few years, I became a mom myself. So my daughter really became
Inspiration.
An inspiration. It's and the will to continue fighting to make this film because, Sandy, as you know, women's stories are often dismissed so easily. You probably hear this right, left, and center.
Well, I'm tired of hearing it, especially in 2016.
I never believed that. And I was like, what's happening in the industry? It's so skewed.
What do you mean you never believed it?
I thought, well, I'll change that.
Oh, okay.
In that sense. Mm-hmm. I was like, it might exist. It's probably there. As a student, you don't think of the reality of the industry. And once you graduate, you realize that the 50% women in your class are going nowhere. No one's hiring them for several years, you know. And so the question really became, what am I going to do on my own to fight for it and to not give up? And, you know, many people came along and became a part of this project.
Well, before we really get into this project, did you ever have a job once you graduated from Columbia? Did you work for somebody?
I couldn't because I was a student and I was on a visa that I couldn't work on. So it many, many years it took me to, you know, be legit and then work.
What a tease, in a sense. You come here to learn these skills and then there's this incidence.
It's very tough. And, you know, especially after 9/11, some of the immigration laws changed all of that. So it became even tougher. But, you know, I have to say, as a filmmaker, I've never been held back from anything that I've done either here or in Pakistan. And it's always been, I've had a freedom to do what I want to do.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Afia Nathaniel, who is an independent filmmaker. And we're talking about her debut feature film, Dukhtar. So let's talk about this movie. It was burning inside of you to tell this story. Mm-hmm. Did you on some level also feel you were giving voice to the voiceless?
Absolutely. And this idea comes again from my own childhood. I mean, I come from a family. I was raised by my grandmother, my great-grandmother. My parents were posted in an Air Force base. So I grew up and was raised by my grandmothers. And what I saw was the incredible amount of sacrifice that women make to raise their children. And these are stories that are never understood or heard in mainstream cinema. So I brought, you know, for me, it was very important to tell this very personal story of a mother and daughter who sacrifices her fate in some ways to find a better life for her own child. And the film is inspired by true events. I wanted to stay true to the integrity of that initial woman whose story inspired me and her courage.
And did you know this woman?
Not personally, but through someone, yes. Mm-hmm.
And did you meet her?
She was a survivor. No, I didn't meet her.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She was a survivor, and she actually kidnapped her two young daughters. One was an infant, and made a run for the road. And she was being hunted down by her husband and the family. And her actual story was far more surreal and far more different than the film. But the seed of courage is what, you know, brings.
Inspired you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so coming back to the story, I think what, for me, this subliminal thing was always wanting to be able to stay true to that idea of courage and integrity. I wasn't so conscious of it being the lesser heard voice. It was more a viewpoint that I felt just needed to be there.
How did you start to make this movie? You're not making it here. You're a woman. It's Pakistan. I can't imagine. And what did I say? It took you 10 years.
The biggest challenge, believe it or not, was the fact that there were two women in the lead. In Pakistan, that was not possible to sell a film with two women in the lead. They would ask me, where's the hero?
Oh,
and I would say, she is the hero.
Now,
and,
who's asking you this? The people who are going to pay for it?
Potential financiers.
Yeah, the funders. Uh-huh.
Then the second question you get asked in Pakistan is, where's the song and dance? Because people want to be entertained. And the idea of entertainment is very different in our culture. You know, it's something that caters to a male fantasy, a male ego.
Oh, beautiful women on the
beautiful, sexy women showing off a large amount of skin and great close-ups of that, you know. Gyrating to some interesting lyrics and music. My film was not going to have any of that. And so that in itself became the hardest selling point. And you have to defend in a market, in a film industry, you have to defend the idea that a woman's story has a market and can
value.
Sell
mm-hmm.
and value. And I think this is a fight that's
universal.
Happening here in Hollywood, right mm-hmm. here. You know, it's nothing different. The same
it's
fight
just
is
that
there.
It's worse.
And I believe the ACLU is looking into it in Hollywood, you know, the practices of hiring and the question of equality and equity, gender equity. So hopefully it goes somewhere here in Hollywood. But coming to US, I think the battle for me personally with a film like this was that it was perceived as the other, too foreign.
For Pakistani audiences?
For raising money. So you can raise money from different sources. In Pakistan, the problem was because it's too female-centric. In the U.S., the problem was it was too foreign.
Got it.
There's subtitles in it. There's unknown cast. There's brown women. Again, you know, it's a brown female filmmaker from a lesser known part of the. So you know, the sell, the package was not relevant.
You're
here.
You're pushing a rock up the mountain.
Exactly. So then I started looking to Europe. You know, Europe is far more open to foreign language films and all of that. So we became part of the Berlin talent market. Which is a great way to, you know, for emerging filmmakers to find a way. How do you raise money? How do you meet people who finance these things? And so that was a great stepping stone to have for the film. And eventually we found financial support from Europe and a bit of nonprofit money in the US. So we were more like a traditional social issue documentary.
Who's the we?
We, as in the producers, the way we raised money, it's something that, you know, documentaries often do. They cobble together a lot of nonprofit money and then a little bit from there, a little bit from
here.
Did
you do Kickstarter-y kind
of
things?
And we tried. You know, in one part of the phase, we did try Indiegogo. That was when the film was optioned to a different producer. And I took the rights back eventually and did everything myself.
So what was your budget?
It's very modest. It's extremely modest. We got a grant from Norway, a production grant, which was 100,000 euros, which was all we ever needed.
I don't know what that is.
100,000 euros is equivalent to $120,000.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that is all we ever needed to film this in Pakistan. You know, so that gives you a sense.
So you move back to Pakistan.
I was pretty much based in New York, but my company is set in Pakistan. So I live between Pakistan and U.S., you know, all the time. And for the film, I spend a lot of time there for sure.
Really talk about making this movie from the ground up. Take us through the process.
You know, for making a film, you really need the right people to work with you. It's not something that you do by yourself. If you've ever looked at the ending credits and you wondered why this 400
so long.
Names,
right.
That's because as a director and producer, you want to be able to work with other people who will further this vision, who will physically be part of this crew and lift the cameras and shoot, you know. So anyway, so finding the right crew was the first step. We had a bit of money, but finding the right people to man this project, literally speaking, man.
Because, I was just going to say, yeah, I know you're speaking
I ended
literally.
Up being the only woman on the crew, even though I tried so hard to find a woman, you know, to work with me. The nature of the film and the filmmaking was very tough. We were going to be filming in a very remote part of Pakistan, the northernmost area, in extremely tough political situation. That area is part of a disputed region between India and Pakistan. So there's heavy military presence.
Boy, did you bite off more than you could chew.
Yeah. It was going to be severe winter, minus 13 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that's in Fahrenheit.
It doesn't matter.
You know, we're cut off from the rest of the world. So no woman was getting permission from her family to come with us to crew for a film like this. So
As opposed to star in it. That was an, I mean, that was not
my,
so difficult.
My two leading ladies were the only other women on the set, you know. So we had to make do with ourselves.
Were the men accommodating? And how did they handle you as the boss?
So coming to the right team, I've worked in Pakistan with this crew for several years. So my cinematographer is a friend.
You had made other films before
And they understood, you know, working with me, they had no problems working with me or I with them. So there was great synergy already.
Okay.
And that's the reason I went into this kind of a production in this kind of a difficult situation, because I knew I had the right team with me to make it happen. And so having the right creative people, having the right technical people, having the right production managers who will take care of logistics and everything on the ground.
You were a cohesive unit worked.
We already existed and came together very organically. And so as a woman, I didn't have the problem that perhaps I may have had had I just come in and flown in right from New York and, you know, was this woman from out there and not from amongst them. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So my set is a great place to be a woman director. I called all the shots. I had a great crew, so I'm very thankful to them, you know, and a great cast. You know, one thing that often strikes people here in the West is the great actors in the film. They ask me, do you even have an industry? And I say, we have a thriving television industry in the country. And we drew a lot of our actors from that pool
mm-hmm.
because we don't really have, you know, casting agencies for film or, you know, for talent. So you literally go around calling people and actors and, you know, scrounging for their phone numbers and all of that. And I cast along, you know, with my crew and through their
opinions.
How
many people are in the film? I mean, completely.
Completely, that's 300 people at
there
least.
There were 300. I'm not talking including the crew. I'm just talking about.
I'm saying with extras, you know, we
there
hired.
There were 300 people
yes,
in
300,
this movie.
There's 300 people you'll see on the screen as well. We hired plenty of extras as we went along, non-actors. Some had speaking roles, some had no speaking roles. And so, you know, it was a pretty epic production. We had chase scenes in the film and there's no production insurance. The actors did all the chase scene stunts themselves.
And there's clearly no unions.
There's clearly no unions. And, you know, we were filming at very high altitudes, 8,000 feet above sea level, on these roads that had a sheer drop on one side.
You should have been filming, you know what I mean? How long did this movie take to make?
The actual filming process was 2 months in the winter, 30 days filming. We didn't stop. It was one go.
Right.
And it had to be done that way. Otherwise, you would never get the same set of people again together. And this was a first-time crew. They had never shot a feature film before. I mean, they had worked on commercials.
Yeah, but you had never directed
and music,
a feature
and I
film.
Had, so we were all first-time
novices
on the set. But it was a great crew. It was the best crew I could have had, you know. Great team. And we had good fun, you know. It was a difficult shoot. But I tell you, we partied as well, you know. We knew how to
Again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Afia Nathaniel, who is a feature film director. Well, actually, she's a director, a writer, a producer, and we're discussing her debut feature, Tuktar. So you make the movie, and then you do the post-production, and then what?
And then the big fish has to be caught, meaning you have to find a distributor who will pick up your film or sell your film, one of those sales agents. And that's a big mafia out there that you got to understand how to
break into,
get the code, and you got to swallow the red pill, you know. Is it the red pill or the blue pill? And if you choose the red pill...
Sorry.
And what we found out that, you know, once Toronto happened, the film opened up in Toronto, we ended up releasing the film in several territories through distributors. We made the deals ourselves, so we didn't hire a third party to do those negotiations. And I think it's a very important part of the learning for artists now in terms of how do you survive? How do you make a living? I think you have to be in control of your rights. You have to know the business side of the film as an artist to survive in this very
cutthroat. It was all learning
industry.
By doing for
Absolutely.
You.
And we had the greatest time. I mean, we made mistakes. We learned from those things. But I think we did a great job opening up in 20 countries in 1 year. And in Pakistan, we had a fantastic four-week run.
I was just going to ask, what was the reception in your native country?
It was better than I had hoped for, actually, frankly. You know, I was a bit apprehensive how... a film like this with a social issue at its core, mm-hmm. like child marriage, you know, how would it be received or how would it play? And I'm very happy to say that our original thought was completely validated when we saw new kinds of audiences come to theaters. This is not the typical male wanting his fantasy to be realized on the screen. This is a guy who wants to see realism on the screen, and it's a thriller, you know. So the film has a kind of commercial bent already in the story, mm-hmm. and so the film appealed to different kinds of audiences. women especially, you know, they came out in droves to support the film. Grandmothers, mothers,
how were the reviews?
The reviews are mixed, you know. We had a fair share of criticism. We also had a fair share of being very warmly embraced.
What was the criticism? Not to focus on the negative. But.
You know, this is a child marriage story. We've seen these stories. There's never been a child marriage story in cinema before, ever told in Pakistan from a woman's perspective, ever. So you have this part of society that likes to dismiss these kinds of stories because guess what? They bring a loss of honor or shame to the country.
Of course.
So the notion of, you know, telling a woman's story or breaking the status quo on those issues is tied to the idea of honor in society, which is, again, what the story and film is doing. You know, it's trying to break the status quo. And in the telling of the film, it was interesting to see that a part of society really took it the wrong way, thinking, you know, this is a criticism of the society these stories should not be told. But then there was an equally loud part of the critics that embraced it and that said, this is the right time to be telling these stories. And it's the same thing we saw with audiences. I think audiences really appreciate it. And this is where the power lies with audiences. You know, the reason why the film ran for 4 weeks straight against major Bollywood and Hollywood releases was because the audiences wanted to see a change in their society. They came to support that change. And I think that's the very first step in wanting and seeing any change is how do you instill the idea of something different in them in the first place, you know.
But how was it received other places? You said it opened in 20 countries. Were the reviews very different?
Very good.
Universally good.
Very. I mean, especially in the U.S., we just were in the middle of finishing our U.S. theatrical release. And Dukhtar became the New York critics pick, you know, here in the U.S. and very warmly received here in the U.S. So we're very thankful to audiences. You know, it's a universal story in so many ways, and people have really responded to that.
That's wonderful. Well, we're running out of time, believe it or not, so I need you to tell me what's on the horizon for you.
I'm on a kind of hiatus right now from writing for a while.
Taking a breather,
but there's another film brewing in my mind, sort of refusing to let go, you know, and it's a fantasy science fiction film, which I hope to write
so
in a few more
weeks. So what goes around comes around, right? That's what started
exactly,
you on this.
Yeah,
oh, that's terrific.
So yeah, look out. It's going to be in English, so there's no subtitles.
And will it be shot here?
Possibly. It depends where the money comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Could be U.S., Europe, Japan, a couple of other places.
But it's also the fact, too, that you're mentoring students, whether it be here, you know, American students or international students. That's
great. I'm really enjoying that. You know, it's come a full circle. I myself have been mentored by so many people in the industry. And I think it's such an important part of the stepping stone in the industry, you know, from the student life into the industry. And without those mentors, it would have been very difficult. So I'm really grateful to those. And I hope in some way I can repay that now back to the next generation, you know.
Even though it's glacial, you do see a difference between 2001 and as we start 2016,
oh, for sure.
Right, in terms of the work that you're doing with the students at Columbia and at NYU.
It is, you know, the students come from such a diverse background. And right now, I think just in terms of diversity and viewpoints, there's such an amazing amount of content coming out. If you look at television right now, there's such great stories being told from all over the place, from all kinds of peoples, you know, all kinds of characters you see on screen that 20 years ago you would not have thought possible, you know, a brown person in a lead role. I mean, in Quantico, you have a female brown person on screen. 7 million people watched her show, you know, in the U.S. alone. So, you know, that kind of momentum, it's ripe for the taking in terms of content creation and different kinds of stories coming out.
Well, thanks to people like you.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank
you. That's
wonderful. You're very generous.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today. It was a really wonderful conversation. I learned a lot. You're a force to be reckoned with.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to all the listeners. Check out our website if you want to. It's dukhtarthefilm.com. That's D-U-K-H-T-A-R, thefilm.com. And our DVDs and Blu-rays will be out soon.
Excellent. Thank you so
much,
Afia. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have someone that you would like to hear interviewed, by all means, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.